It doesn't sound like you're talking underwater anymore. It's fine now. It's okay. God, I thought for a while I was going to go crazy. But I feel fine now. I can hear everything. Listen, honey, I'll make coffee. There's some juice, too. I have to go, she said. I'm late for something. But I'll come back. We'll go out for lunch sometime. We need to talk. I just can't sleep on this side of my head is all, he went on. He followed her into the living room. She lit a cigarette. That's what happened. I slept all night on this side of my head and my ear plugged up. I think I'll be all right as long as I don't forget and sleep on this side of my head. If I'm careful. You know what I'm saying? If I can just sleep on my back or else on my left side. She didn't look at him. Not forever, of course not, I know that. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do it the rest of my life. But for a while, anyway. Just my left side, or else flat on my back. But even as he said this, he began to feel afraid of the night that was coming. He began to fear the moment he would begin to make his preparations for bed and what might happen afterward. That time was hours away, but already he was afraid. What if, in the middle of the night, he accidentally turned onto his right side, and the weight of his head pressing into the pillow were to seal the wax again into the dark canals of his ear? What if he woke up then, unable to hear, the ceiling inches from his head? Good God, he said. Jesus, this is awful. Inez, I just had something like a terrible nightmare. Inez, where do you have to go? I told you, she said as she put everything back into her purse and made ready to leave. She looked at her watch. I'm late for something. She went to the door, but at the door she turned and said something else to him. He didn't listen. He didn't want to. He watched her lips move until she'd said what she had to say. When she'd finished, she said, goodbye. Then she opened the door and closed it behind her. He went into the bedroom to dress, but in a minute he hurried out, wearing only his trousers, and went to the door. He opened it and stood there, listening. On the landing below, he heard Inez thank Mrs. Matthews for the oil. He heard the old woman say, you're welcome. And then he heard her draw a connection between her late husband and himself. He heard her say, leave me your number. I'll call if something happens. You never know. I hope you don't have to, Inez said. But I'll give it to you anyway. Do you have something to write it down with? Lloyd heard Mrs. Matthews open a drawer and rummage through it. Then her old woman's voice said, okay. Inez gave her their telephone number at home. Thanks, she said. It was nice meeting you, Mrs. Matthews said. He listened as Inez went on down the stairs and opened the front door. Then he heard it close. He waited until he heard her start their car and drive away. Then he shut the door and went back into the bedroom to finish dressing. After he'd put on his shoes and tied the laces, he lay down on the bed and pulled the covers up to his chin. He let his arms rest under the covers at his sides. He closed his eyes and pretended it was night and pretended he was going to fall asleep. Then he brought his arms up and crossed them over his chest to see how this position would suit him. He kept his eyes closed, trying it out. All right, he thought, okay. If he didn't want that ear to plug up again, he'd have to sleep on his back, that was all. He knew he could do it. He just couldn't forget, even in his sleep, and turn onto the wrong side. 4 or 5 hours sleep a night was all he needed anyway. He'd manage. Worse things could happen to a man. In a way, it was a challenge. But he was up to it. He knew he was. In a minute, he threw back the covers and got up. He still had the better part of the day ahead of him. He went into the kitchen, bent down in front of the little refrigerator, and took out a fresh bottle of champagne. He worked the plastic cork out of the bottle as carefully as he could, but there was still the festive pop of champagne being opened. He rinsed the baby oil out of his glass, then poured it full of champagne. He took the glass over to the sofa and sat down. He put the glass on the coffee table. Up went his feet onto the coffee table next to the champagne. He leaned back. But after a time, he began to worry some more about the night that was coming on. What if, despite all his efforts, the wax decided to plug his other ear? He closed his eyes and shook his head. Pretty soon, he got up and went into the bedroom. He He undressed and put his pajamas back on. Then he moved back into the living room. He sat down on the sofa once more, and once more put his feet up. He reached over and turned the TV on. He adjusted the volume. He knew he couldn't keep from worrying about what might happen when he went to bed. It was just something he'd have to learn to live with. In a way, this whole business reminded him of the thing with the donuts and champagne. It was not that remarkable at all if you thought about it. He took some champagne, but it didn't taste right. He ran his tongue over his lips, then wiped his mouth on his sleeve. He looked and saw a film of oil on the champagne. He got up and carried the glass to the sink, where he poured it into the drain. He took the bottle of champagne into the living room and made himself comfortable on the sofa. He held the bottle by its neck as he drank. He wasn't in the habit of drinking from the bottle, but it didn't seem that much out of the ordinary. He decided that even if he were to fall asleep sitting up on the sofa in the middle of the afternoon, it wouldn't be any more strange than somebody having to lie on his back for hours at a time. He lowered his head to peer out the window. Judging from the angle of sunlight and the shadows that had entered the room, he guessed it was about 3 o'clock. Where I'm calling from. JP and I are on the front porch at Frank Martin's drying out facility. Like the rest of us at Frank Martin's, JP is first and foremost a drunk. But he's also a chimney sweep. It's his first time here and he's scared. I've been here once before. What's to say? I'm back. JP's real name is Joe Penny, but he says I should call him JP. He's about 30 years old, younger than I am. Not much younger, but a little. He's telling me how he decided to go into his line of work, and he wants to use his hands when he talks. But his hands tremble. I mean, they won't keep still. This has never happened to me before, he says. He means the trembling. I tell him I sympathize. I tell him the shakes will idle down. And they will. But it takes time. We've only been in here a couple of days. We're not out of the woods yet. JP has these shakes, and every so often a nerve, maybe it isn't a nerve, but it's something, begins to jerk in my shoulder. Sometimes it's at the side of my neck. When this happens, my mouth dries up. It's an effort just to swallow then. I know something's about to happen, and I want to head it off. I want to hide from it. That's what I want to do. Just close my eyes and let it pass by. Let it take the next man. JP can wait a minute. I saw a seizure yesterday morning. A guy they call Tiny. A big fat guy, an electrician from Santa Rosa. They said he'd been in here for nearly 2 weeks and that he was over the hump. He was going home in a day or two and would spend New Year's Eve with his wife in front of the TV. On New Year's Eve, Tiny planned to drink hot chocolate and eat cookies. Yesterday morning, he seemed just fine when he came down for breakfast. He was letting out with quacking noises, showing some guy how he called ducks right down onto his head. Blam, blam, said Tiny, picking off a couple. Tiny's hair was damp and slicked back along the sides of his head. He'd just come out of the shower. He'd also nicked himself on the chin with his razor. But so what? Just about everybody at Frank Martin's has nicks on his face. It's something that happens. Tiny edged in at the head of the table and began telling about something that had happened on one of his drinking bouts. People at the table laughed and shook their heads as they shoveled up their eggs. Tiny would say something, grin, then look around the table for a sign of recognition. We'd all done things just as bad and crazy, so sure, that's why we laughed. Tiny had scrambled eggs on his plate, and some biscuits and honey. I was at the table, but I wasn't hungry. I had some coffee in front of me. Suddenly, Tiny wasn't there anymore. He'd gone over in his chair with a big clatter. He was on his back on the floor, with his eyes closed, his heels drumming the linoleum. People hollered for Frank Martin, but he was right there. A couple of guys got down on the floor beside Tiny. One of the guys put his fingers inside Tiny's mouth and tried to hold his tongue. Frank Martin yelled, "Everybody stand back!" Then I noticed that the bunch of us were leaning over Tiny, just looking at him, not able to take our eyes off him. "Give him air," Frank Martin said. Then he ran into the office and called the ambulance. Tiny is on board again today. Talk about bouncing back. This morning, Frank Martin drove the station wagon to the hospital to get him. Tiny got back too late for his eggs, but he took some coffee into the dining room and sat down at the table anyway. Somebody in the kitchen made toast for him, but Tiny didn't eat it. He just sat with his coffee and looked into his cup. Every now and then, he moved his cup back and forth in front of him. I'd like to ask him if he had any signal just before it happened. I'd like to know if he felt his ticker skip a beat or begin to race. Did his eyelid twitch? But I'm not about to say anything. He doesn't look like he's hot to talk about it anyway. But what happened to Tiny is something I won't ever forget. Old Tiny, flat on the floor, kicking his heels. So every time this little flitter starts up anywhere, I draw some breath and wait to find myself on my back looking up, somebody's fingers in my mouth. In his chair on the front porch, JP keeps his hands in his lap. I smoke cigarettes and use an old coal bucket for an ashtray. I listen to JP ramble on. It's 11 o'clock in the morning, an hour and a half until lunch. Neither one of us is hungry. But just the same, we look forward to going inside and sitting down at the table. Maybe we'll get hungry. What's JP talking about anyway? He's saying how when he was 12 years old, he fell into a well in the vicinity of the farm he grew up on. It was a dry well, lucky for him. Or unlucky, he says, looking around him and shaking his head. He knows how late that afternoon, after he'd been located, his dad hauled him out with a rope. JP had wet his pants down there. He'd suffered all kinds of terror in that well, hollering for help, waiting, and then hollering some more. He hollered himself hoarse before it was over. But he told me that being at the bottom of that well had made a lasting impression. He'd sat there and looked up at the well mouth. Way up at the top, he could see a circle of blue sky. Every once in a while, a white cloud passed over. A flock of birds flew across, and it seemed to JP their wing beats set up this odd commotion. He heard other things. He heard tiny rustlings above him in the well, which made him wonder if things might fall down into his hair. He was thinking of insects. He heard wind blow over the well mouth, and that sound made an impression on him too. In short, everything about his life was different for him at the bottom of that well. But nothing fell on him, and nothing closed off that little circle of blue. Then his dad came along with the rope, and it wasn't long before JP was back in the world he'd always lived in. Keep talking, JP. Then what? I say. When he was 18 or 19 years old and out of high school and had nothing whatsoever he wanted to do with his life, he went across town one afternoon to visit a friend. This friend lived in a house with a fireplace. JP and his friend sat around drinking beer and batting the breeze. They played some records. Then the doorbell rings. The friend goes to the door. This young woman chimney sweep is there with her cleaning things. She's wearing a top hat, the sight of which knocked JP for a loop. She tells JP's friend that she has an appointment to clean the fireplace. The friend lets her in and bows. The young woman doesn't pay him any mind. She spreads a blanket on the hearth and lays out her gear. She's wearing these black pants, black shirt, black shoes, and socks. Of course, by now she's taken her hat off. JP says it nearly drove him nuts to look at her. She does the work, she cleans the chimney, while JP and his friend play records and drink beer. But they watch her, and they watch what she does. Now and then JP and his friend look at each other and grin, or else they wink. They raise their eyebrows when the upper half of the young woman disappears into the chimney. She was all right looking, too, JP said. When she'd finished her work, she rolled her things up in the blanket. From JP's friend, she took a check that had been made out to her by his parents. And then she asks the friend if he wants to kiss her. It's supposed to bring good luck, she says. That does it for JP. The friend rolls his eyes. He clowns some more. Then, probably blushing, he kisses her on the cheek. At this minute, JP made his mind up about something. He put his beer down. He got up from the sofa. He went over to the young woman as she was starting to go out the door. Me too? JP said to her. She swept her eyes over him. JP says he could feel his heart knocking. The young woman's name, it turns out, was Roxy. Sure, Roxy says. Why not? I've got some extra kisses. and she kissed him a good one right on the lips and then turned to go. Like that, quick as a wink, JP followed her onto the porch. He held the porch screen door for her. He went down the steps with her and out to the drive where she'd parked her panel truck. It was something that was out of his hands. Nothing else in the world counted for anything. He knew he'd met somebody who could set his legs a-tremble. He could feel her kiss still burning on his lips, etc. JP couldn't begin to sort anything out. He was filled with sensations that were carrying him every which way. He opened the rear door of the panel truck for her. He helped her store her things inside. Thanks, she told him. Then he blurted it out, that he'd like to see her again. Would she go to a movie with him sometime? He'd realized, too, what he wanted to do with his life. He wanted to do what she did. He wanted to be a chimney sweep. But he didn't tell her that then. JP says she put her hands on her hips and looked him over. Then she found a business card in the front seat of her truck. She gave it to him. She said, call this number after 10 tonight. We can talk. I have to go now. She put the top hat on and then took it off. She looked at JP once more. She must have liked what she saw because this time she grinned. He told her there was a smudge near her mouth. Then she got into her truck, tooted the horn, and drove away. Then what, I say? Don't stop now, JP. I was interested. But I would have listened if he'd been going on about how one day he decided to start pitching horseshoes. It rained last night. The clouds are banked up against the hills across the valley. JP clears his throat and looks at the hills and the clouds. He pulls his chin. Then he goes on with what he was saying. Roxy starts going out with him on dates. And little by little, he talks her into letting him go along on jobs with her. But Roxy's in business with her father and brother, and they've got just the right amount of work. They don't need anybody else. Besides, who was this guy JP? JP what? Watch out, they warned her. So she and JP saw some movies together. They went to a few dances. But mainly the courtship revolved around their cleaning chimneys together. Before you know it, JP says, they're talking about tying the knot. And after a while they do it, they get married. JP's new father-in-law takes him in as a full partner. In a year or so, Roxy has a kid. She's quit being a chimney sweep. At any rate, she's quit doing the work. Pretty soon she has another kid. JP's in his mid-20s by now. He's buying a house. He says he was happy with his life. I was happy with the way things were going, he says. I had everything I wanted. I had a wife and kids I loved, and I was doing what I wanted to do with my life. But for some reason, who knows why we do what we do, his drinking picks up. For a long time he drinks beer and beer only. Any kind of beer, it didn't matter. He says he could drink beer 24 hours a day. He'd drink beer at night when he watched TV. Sure, once in a while he drank hard stuff, but that was only if they went out on the town, which was not often, or else when they had company over. Then a time comes, he doesn't know why, when he makes the switch from beer to gin and tonic. And he'd have more gin and tonic after dinner, sitting in front of the TV. There was always a glass of gin and tonic in his hand. He says he actually liked the taste of it. He began stopping off after work for drinks before he went home to have more drinks. Then he began missing some dinners. He just wouldn't show up. Or else he'd show up, but he wouldn't want anything to eat. He'd filled up on snacks at the bar. Sometimes he'd walk in the door and for no good reason throw his lunch pail across the living room. When Roxy yelled at him, he'd turn around and go out again. He moved his drinking time up to early afternoon while he was still supposed to be working. He tells me that he was starting off the morning with a couple of drinks. He'd have a belt of the stuff before he brushed his teeth. Then he'd have his coffee. He'd go to work with a thermos bottle of vodka in his lunch pail. JP quits talking. He just clams up. What's going on? I'm listening. It's helping me relax, for one thing. It's taking me away from my own situation. After a minute, I say, what the hell? Go on, JP. He's pulling his chin, but pretty soon he starts talking again. JP and Roxy are having some real fights now. I mean, fights. JP says that one time she hit him in the face with her fist and broke his nose. Look at this, he says. Right here. He shows me a line across the bridge of his nose. That's a broken nose. He returned the favor. He dislocated her shoulder for her. Another time he split her lip. They beat on each other in front of the kids. Things got out of hand. But he kept on drinking. He couldn't stop. And nothing could make him stop. Not even with Roxy's dad and her brother threatening to beat the hell out of him. They told Roxy she should take the kids and clear out. But Roxy said it was her problem. She got herself into it, and she'd solve it. Now JP gets real quiet again. He hunches his shoulders and pulls down in his chair. He watches a car driving down the road between this place and the hills. I say, I want to hear the rest of this, JP. You better keep talking. I just don't know, he says. He shrugs. It's all right, I say. And I mean it's okay for him to tell it. Go on, JP. One way she tried to fix things, JP says, was by finding a boyfriend. JP would like to know how she found the time with the house and kids. I look at him and I'm surprised. He's a grown man. If you want to do that, I say, you find the time. You make the time. JP shakes his head. I guess so, he says. Anyway, he found out about it, about Roxy's boyfriend, and he went wild. He manages to get Roxy's wedding ring off her finger, and when he does, he cuts it into several pieces with a pair of wire cutters. Good, solid fun. They'd already gone a couple of rounds on this occasion. On his way to work the next morning, he gets arrested on a drunk charge. He loses his driver's license. He can't drive the truck to work anymore. Just as well, he says. He'd already fallen off a roof the week before and broken his thumb. It was just a matter of time until he broke his neck, he says. He was here at Frank Martin's to dry out and to figure out how to get his life back on track. But he wasn't here against his will, any more than I was. We weren't locked up. We could leave any time we wanted. But a minimum stay of a week was recommended, and 2 weeks or a month was, as they put it, strongly advised. As I said, this is my second time at Frank Martin's. When I was trying to sign a check to pay in advance for a week's stay, Frank Martin said, "The holidays are always bad. Maybe you should think of sticking around a little longer this time. Think in terms of a couple of weeks. Can you do a couple of weeks? Think about it anyway. You don't have to decide anything right now," he said. He held his thumb on the check and I signed my name. Then I walked my girlfriend to the front door and said goodbye. "Goodbye," she said, and she lurched into the door jamb and then onto the porch. It's late afternoon. It's raining. I go from the door to the window. I move the curtain and watch her drive away. She's in my car. She's drunk. But I'm drunk too, and there's nothing I can do. I make it to a big chair that's close to the radiator and I sit down. Some guys look up from their TV. Then they shift back to what they were watching. I just sit there. Now and then I look up at something that's happening on the screen. Later that afternoon, the front door banged open and JP was brought in between these two big guys. His father-in-law and brother-in-law, I find out afterward. They steered JP across the room. The old guys signed him in and gave Frank Martin a check. Then these two guys helped JP upstairs. I guess they put him to bed. Pretty soon the old guy and the other guy came downstairs and headed for the front door. They couldn't seem to get out of the place fast enough. It was like they couldn't wait to wash their hands of all this. I didn't blame them. Hell no. I don't know how I'd act if I was in their shoes. A day and a half later, JP and I meet up on the front porch. We shake hands and comment on the weather. JP has a case of the shakes. We sit down and prop our feet up on the railing. We lean back in our chairs like we're just out there taking our ease, like we might be getting ready to talk about our bird dogs. That's when JP gets going with his story. It's cold out, but not too cold. It's a little overcast. Frank Martin comes outside to finish his cigar. He has on a sweater buttoned all the way up. Frank Martin is short and heavyset. He has curly gray hair and a small head. His head is too small for the rest of his body. Frank Martin puts the cigar in his mouth and stands with his arms crossed over his chest. He works that cigar in his mouth and looks across the valley. He stands there like a prize fighter, like somebody who knows the score. JP gets quiet again. I mean, he's hardly breathing. I toss my cigarette into the coal bucket and look hard at JP, who scoots farther down in his chair. JP pulls up his collar. What the hell's going on, I wonder? Frank Martin uncrosses his arms and takes a puff on the cigar. He lets the smoke carry out of his mouth. Then he raises his chin toward the hills and says, Jack London used to have a big place on the other side of this valley. Right over there behind that green hill you're looking at. But alcohol killed him. Let that be a lesson to you. He was a better man than any of us. But he couldn't handle the stuff either. Frank Martin looks at what's left of his cigar. It's gone out. He tosses it into the bucket. You guys want to read something while you're here? Read that book of his, The Call of the Wild. You know the one I'm talking about? We have it inside if you want to read something. It's about this animal that's half dog and half wolf. End of sermon, he says, and then hitches his pants up and tugs his sweater down. I'm going inside, he says. See you at lunch. I feel like a bug when he's around, JP says. He makes me feel like a bug. JP shakes his head. Then he says, Jack London. What a name. I wish I had me a name like that, instead of the name I got. My wife brought me up here the first time. That's when we were still together, trying to make things work out. She brought me here and stayed around for an hour or two, talking to Frank Martin in private. Then she left. The next morning, Frank Martin got me aside and said, We can help you, if you want help and want to listen to what we say. But I didn't know if they could help me or not. Part of me wanted help, but there was another part. This time around, it was my girlfriend who drove me here. She was driving my car. She drove us through a rainstorm. We drank champagne all the way. We were both drunk when she pulled up in the drive. She intended to drop me off, turn around, and drive home again. She had things to do. One thing she had to do was go to work the next day. She was a secretary. She had an okay job with this electronic parts firm. She also had this mouthy teenaged son. I wanted her to get a room in town, spend the night, and then drive home. I don't know if she got the room or not. I haven't heard from her since she led me up the front steps the other day and walked me into Frank Martin's office and said, Guess who's here? But I wasn't mad at her. In the first place, she didn't have any idea what she was letting herself in for when she said I could stay with her after my wife asked me to leave. I felt sorry for her. The reason I felt sorry for her was that on the day before Christmas, her pap smear came back and the news was not cheery. She'd have to go back to the doctor and real soon. That kind of news was reason enough for both of us to start drinking. So what we did was get ourselves good and drunk. And on Christmas Day, we were still drunk. We had to go out to a restaurant to eat because she didn't feel like cooking. The two of us and her mouthy teenaged son opened some presents, and then we went to this steakhouse near her apartment. I wasn't hungry. I had some soup and a hot roll. I drank a bottle of wine with the soup. She drank some wine too. Then we started in on Bloody Marys. For the next couple of days, I didn't eat anything except salted nuts. But I drank a lot of bourbon. Then I said to her, Sugar, I think I'd better pack up. I better go back to Frank Martin's. She tried to explain to her son that she was going to be gone for a while and he'd have to get his own food. But right as we were going out the door, this mouthy kid screamed at us. He screamed, The hell with you! I hope you never come back! I hope you kill yourselves! Imagine this kid. Before we left town, I had her stop at the package store, where I bought us the champagne. We stopped someplace else for plastic glasses. Then we picked up a bucket of fried chicken. We set out for Frank Martin's in this rainstorm, drinking and listening to music. She drove. I looked after the radio and poured. We tried to make a little party of it, but we were sad, too. There was that fried chicken, but we didn't eat any. I guess she got home okay. I think I would have heard something if she didn't. But she hasn't called me, and I haven't called her. Maybe she's had some news about herself by now. Then again, maybe she hasn't heard anything. Maybe it was all a mistake. Maybe it was somebody else's smear. But she has my car, and I have things at her house. I know we'll be seeing each other again. They clang an old farm bell here to call you for mealtime. JP and I get out of our chairs and we go inside. It's starting to get too cold on the porch anyway. We can see our breath drifting out from us as we talk. New Year's Eve morning, I try to call my wife. There's no answer. It's okay. But even if it wasn't okay, what am I supposed to do? The last time we talked on the phone, a couple of weeks ago, we screamed at each other. I hung a few names on her. Wet brain, she said, and put the phone back where it belonged. But I wanted to talk to her now. Something had to be done about my stuff. I still had things at her house, too. One of the guys here is a guy who travels. He goes to Europe and places. That's what he says, anyway. Business, he says. He also says he has his drinking under control and he doesn't have any idea why he's here at Frank Martin's. But he doesn't remember getting here. He laughs about it, about his not remembering. Anyone can have a blackout, he says. That doesn't prove a thing. He's not a drunk. He tells us this and we listen. That's a serious charge to make, he says. That kind of talk can ruin a good man's prospects. He says that if he'd only stick to whiskey and water, no ice, he'd never have these blackouts. It's the ice they put into your drink that does it. Who do you know in Egypt? He asks me. I can use a few names over there. For New Year's Eve dinner, Frank Martin serves steak and baked potato. My appetite's coming back. I clean up everything on my plate, and I could eat more. I look over at Tiny's plate. Hell, he's hardly touched a thing. His steak is just sitting there. Tiny is not the same old Tiny. The poor bastard had planned to be at home tonight. He'd planned to be in his robe and slippers in front of the TV, holding hands with his wife. Now he's afraid to leave. I can understand. One seizure means you're ready for another. Tiny hasn't told any more nutty stories on himself since it happened. He's stayed quiet and kept to himself. I ask him if I can have his steak, and he pushes his plate over to me. Some of us are still up, sitting around the TV, watching Times Square, when Frank Martin comes in to show us his cake. He brings it around and shows it to each of us. I know he didn't make it. It's just a bakery cake. But it's still a cake. It's a big white cake. Across the top, there's writing in pink letters. The writing says, Happy New Year, one day at a time. I don't want any stupid cake, says the guy who goes to Europe and places. Where's the champagne? He says and laughs. We all go into the dining room. Frank Martin cuts the cake. I sit next to JP. JP eats two slices and drinks a Coke. I eat a piece and wrap another piece in a napkin, thinking of later. JP lights a cigarette. His hands are steady now. And he tells me his wife is coming in the morning, the first day of the new year. That's great, I say. I nod. I lick the frosting off my finger. That's good news, JP. I'll introduce you, he says. I look forward to it, I say. We say goodnight. We say Happy New Year. I use a napkin on my fingers. We shake hands. I go to the phone, put in a dime, and call my wife, Collect. But nobody answers this time either. I think about calling my girlfriend, and I'm dialing her number when I realize I really don't want to talk to her. She's probably at home watching the same thing on TV that I've been watching. Anyway, I don't want to talk to her. I hope she's okay. But if she has something wrong with her, I don't want to know about it. After breakfast, JP and I take coffee out to the porch. The sky is clear, but it's cold enough for sweaters and jackets. She asked me if she should bring the kids, JP says. I told her she should keep the kids at home. Can you imagine? My God, I don't want my kids up here. We use the coal bucket for an ashtray. We look across the valley to where Jack London used to live. We're drinking more coffee when this car turns off the road and comes down the drive. That's her, JP says. He puts his cup next to his chair. He gets up and goes down the steps. I see this woman stop the car and set the brake. I see JP open the door. I watch her get out, and I see them hug each other. I look away. Then I look back. JP takes her by the arm, and they come up the stairs. This woman broke a man's nose once. She has had two kids and much trouble, but she loves this man who has her by the arm. I get up from the chair. This is my friend, JP says to his wife. Hey, this is Roxy. Roxy takes my hand. She's a tall, good-looking woman in a knit cap. She has on a coat, a heavy sweater, and slacks. I recall what JP told me about the boyfriend and the wire cutters. I don't see any wedding ring. That's in pieces somewhere, I guess. Her hands are broad and the fingers have these big knuckles. This is a woman who can make fists if she has to. I've heard about you, I say. JP told me how you got acquainted. Something about a chimney, JP said. Yes, a chimney, she says. There's probably a lot else he didn't tell you, she says. I bet he didn't tell you everything, she says and laughs. Then, she can't wait any longer, she slips her arm around JP and kisses him on the cheek. They start to move to the door. Nice meeting you, she says. Hey, did he tell you he's the best sweep in the business? Come on now, Roxy, JP says. He has his hand on the doorknob. He told me he learned everything he knew from you, I say. Well, that much is sure true, she says. She laughs again, but it's like she's thinking about something else. JP turns the doorknob. Roxy lays her hand over his. Joe, can't we go into town for lunch? Can't I take you someplace? JP clears his throat. He says, It hasn't been a week yet. He takes his hand off the doorknob and brings his fingers to his chin. I think they'd like it if I didn't leave the place for a little while yet. We can have some coffee here, he says. That's fine, she says. Her eyes work over to me again. I'm glad Joe's made a friend. Nice to meet you, she says. They start to go inside. I know it's a dumb thing to do, but I do it anyway. Roxy, I say, and they stop in the doorway and look at me. I need some luck, I say. No kidding. I could do with a kiss myself. JP looks down. He's still holding the knob, even though the door is open. He turns the knob back and forth. But I keep looking at her. Roxy grins. I'm not a sweep anymore, she says. Not for years. Didn't Joe tell you that? But sure, I'll kiss you, sure. She moves over. She takes me by the shoulders. I'm a big man. And she plants this kiss on my lips. How's that? She says. That's fine, I say. Nothing to it, she says. She's still holding me by the shoulders. She's looking me right in the eyes. Good luck, she says, and then she lets go of me. See you later, pal, JP says. He opens the door all the way and they go in. I sit down on the front steps and light a cigarette. I watch what my hand does, then I blow out the match. I've got the shakes. I started out with them this morning. This morning, I wanted something to drink. It's depressing, but I didn't say anything about it to JP. I try to put my mind on something else. I'm thinking about chimney sweeps, all that stuff I heard from JP, when for some reason I start to think about a house my wife and I once lived in. That house didn't have a chimney, so I don't know what makes me remember it now. But I remember the house and how we'd only been in there a few weeks when I heard a noise outside one morning. It was Sunday morning, and it was still dark in the bedroom. But there was this pale light coming in from the bedroom window. I listened. I could hear something scrape against the side of the house. I jumped out of bed and went to look. My God, my wife says, sitting up in bed and shaking the hair away from her face. Then she starts to laugh. It's Mr. Venturini, she says. I forgot to tell you. He said he was coming to paint the house today, early, before it gets too hot. I forgot all about it, she says and laughs. Come on back to bed, honey. It's just him.
In a minute, I say. I push the curtain away from the window. Outside, this old guy in white overalls is standing next to his ladder. The sun is just starting to break above the mountains. The old guy and I look each other over. It's the landlord, all right. This old guy in coveralls. But his coveralls are too big for him. He needs a shave, too. And he's wearing this baseball cap to cover his bald head. God damn it, I think, if he isn't a weird old fellow. And a wave of happiness comes over me that I'm not him. That I'm me, and that I'm inside this bedroom with my wife. He jerks his thumb toward the sun. He pretends to wipe his forehead. He's letting me know he doesn't have all that much time. The old fart breaks into a grin. It's then I realize I'm naked. I look down at myself. I look at him again and shrug. What did he expect? My wife laughs.
Come on, she says. Get back in this bed right now, this minute. Come on back to bed.
I let go of the curtain, but I keep standing there at the window. I can see the old fellow nod to himself like he's saying, Go on, sonny, go back to bed. I understand. He tugs on the bill of his cap. Then he sets about his business. He picks up his bucket. He starts climbing the ladder. I lean back into the step behind me now and cross one leg over the other. Maybe later this afternoon I'll try calling my wife again. And then I'll call to see what's happening with my girlfriend. But I don't want to get her mouthy kid on the line. If I do call, I hope he'll be out somewhere doing whatever he does when he's not around the house. I try to remember if I ever read any Jack London books. I can't remember. But there was a story of his I read in high school. To Build a Fire, it was called. This guy in the Yukon is freezing. Imagine it. He's actually going to freeze to death if he can't get a fire going. With a fire, he can dry his socks and things and warm himself. He gets his fire going, but then something happens to it. A branch full of snow drops on it. It goes out. Meanwhile, it's getting colder. Night is coming on. I bring some change out of my pocket. I'll try my wife first. If she answers, I'll wish her a happy new year. But that's it. I won't bring up business. I won't raise my voice, not even if she starts something. She'll ask me where I'm calling from, and I'll have to tell her. I won't say anything about New Year's resolutions. There's no way to make a joke out of this. After I talk to her, I'll call my girlfriend. Maybe I'll call her first. I'll just have to hope I don't get her kid on the line. Hello, sugar, I'll say when she answers. It's me. The Train, for John Cheever. The woman was called Miss Dent, and earlier that evening she'd held a gun on a man. She'd made him get down in the dirt and plead for his life. While the man's eyes welled with tears and his fingers picked at leaves, she pointed the revolver at him and told him things about himself. She tried to make him see that he couldn't keep trampling on people's feelings. Be still, she'd said. Although the man was only digging his fingers into the dirt and moving his legs a little out of fear. When she had finished talking, when she had said all she could think of to say to him, she put her foot on the back of his head and pushed his face into the dirt. Then she put the revolver into her handbag and walked back to the railway station. She sat on a bench in the deserted waiting room with the handbag on her lap. The ticket office was closed. No one was around. Even the parking lot outside the station was empty. She let her eyes rest on the big wall clock. She wanted to stop thinking about the man and how he'd acted toward her after taking what he wanted. But she knew she would remember for a long time the sound he made through his nose as he got down on his knees. She took a breath, closed her eyes, and listened for the sound of a train. The waiting room door opened. Miss Dent looked in that direction as two people came inside. One person was an old man with white hair and a white silk cravat. The other was a middle-aged woman wearing eyeshadow, lipstick, and a rose-colored knit dress. The evening had turned cool, but neither of the people wore a coat, and the old man was without shoes. They stopped in the doorway, seemingly astounded at finding someone in the waiting room. They tried to act as if her presence there was not a disappointment. The woman said something to the old man, but Miss Dent didn't catch what it was the woman had said. The couple moved on into the room. It seemed to Miss Dent that they gave off an air of agitation, of having just left somewhere in a great hurry and not yet being able to find a way to talk about it. It might be, Miss Dent thought, that they'd had too much to drink as well. The woman and the white-haired old man looked at the clock as if it might tell them something about their situation and what they were supposed to do next. Miss Dent also turned her eyes to the clock. There was nothing in the waiting room that announced when trains arrived and departed, but she was prepared to wait for any length of time. She knew if she waited long enough, a train would come along and she could board it, and it would take her away from this place. "Good evening," the old man said to Miss Dent. He said this, she thought, as if it had been a normal summer's night and he were an important old man wearing shoes and an evening jacket.
"Good evening," Miss Dent said.
The woman in the knit dress looked at her in a way that was calculated to let Miss Dent know the woman was not happy at finding her in the waiting room. The old man and the woman seated themselves on a bench directly across the lobby from Miss Dent. She watched as the old man gave the knees of his trousers a little tug and then crossed one leg over the other and began to wag his stockinged foot. He took a pack of cigarettes and a cigarette holder from his shirt pocket. He inserted the cigarette into the holder and brought his hand up to his shirt pocket. Then he reached into his trouser pockets.
"I don't have a light," he said to the woman.
"I don't smoke," the woman said. "I should think if you knew anything about me, you'd know that much. If you really must smoke, she may have a match."
The woman raised her chin and looked sharply at Miss Dent. But Miss Dent shook her head. She pulled the handbag closer. She held her knees together, her fingers gripping the bag.
"So on top of everything else, no matches," the white-haired old man said. He checked his pockets once more. Then he sighed and removed the cigarette from the holder.
He pushed the cigarette back into the pack. He put the cigarettes and the cigarette holder into his shirt pocket. The woman began to speak in a language that Miss Dent did not understand. She thought it might be Italian because the rapid-fire words sounded like words she'd heard Sophia Loren use in a film. The old man shook his head.
"I can't follow you, you know. You're going too fast for me. You'll have to slow down. You'll have to speak English. I can't follow you," he said.
Miss Dent released her grasp on the handbag and moved it from her lap to a place next to her on the bench. She stared at the catch on the handbag. She wasn't sure what she should do. It was a small waiting room, and she hated to get up suddenly and move somewhere else to sit. Her eyes traveled to the clock.
"I can't get over that bunch of nuts back there," the woman said. "It's colossal. It's simply too much for words. My God."
The woman said this and shook her head. She slumped against the bench as if exhausted. She raised her eyes and stared briefly at the ceiling. The old man took the silk cravat between his fingers and began idly to rub the material back and forth. He opened a button on his shirt and tucked the cravat inside. He seemed to be thinking about something else as the woman went on.
"It's that girl I feel sorry for," the woman said. "That poor soul alone in a house filled with simps and vipers. She's the one I feel sorry for, and she'll be the one to pay. None of the rest of them. Certainly not that imbecile they call Captain Nick. He isn't responsible for anything, not him," the woman said.
The old man raised his eyes and looked around the waiting room. He gazed for a time at Miss Dent. Miss Dent looked past his shoulder and through the window. There she could see the tall lamp post, its light shining on the empty parking lot. She held her hands together in her lap and tried to keep her attention on her own affairs, but she couldn't help hearing what these people said.
"I can tell you this much," the woman said. "The girl is the extent of my concern. Who cares about the rest of that tribe? Their entire existence is taken up with café au lait and cigarettes, their precious Swiss chocolate and those goddamned macaws. Nothing else means anything to them," the woman said. "What do they care? If I never see that outfit again, it'll be too soon. Do you understand me?"
Sure, I understand,
the old man said.
Of course.
He put his feet on the floor and then brought his other leg up over his knee.
But don't fret about it now, he said.
Don't fret about it, he says. Why don't you take a look at yourself in the mirror? The woman said.
Don't worry about me, the old man said. Worse things have happened to me, and I'm still here.
He laughed quietly and shook his head.
Don't worry about me.
How can I help not worrying about you? The woman said. Who else is going to worry about you? Is this woman with the handbag going to worry about you? She said, stopping long enough to glare at Miss Dent. I'm serious, amico mio. Note, amico mio. Italian, my friend. End of note. Just look at yourself. My God, if I didn't already have so many things on my mind, I could have a nervous breakdown right here. Tell me who else there is to worry about you if I don't worry. I'm asking a serious question. You know so much, the woman said. So answer me that. The white-haired old man got to his feet and then sat down again.
Just don't worry about me, he said. Worry about someone else. Worry about the girl and Captain Nick if you want to worry. You were in the other room when he said, I'm not serious, but I'm in love with her. Those were his exact words.
I knew something like that was coming, the woman cried. She closed her fingers and brought her hands up to her temples. I knew you'd tell me something like that. But I'm not surprised either. No, I'm not. A leopard doesn't change its spots. Truer words were never spoken. Live and learn. But when are you going to wake up, you old fool? Answer me that, she said to him. Are you like the mule that first has to be hit between the eyes with a 2x4? Oh, Dio mio. Why don't you go look at yourself in the mirror? The woman said. Take a good long look while you're at it. The old man got up from the bench and moved over to the drinking fountain. He put one hand behind his back, turned the knob, and bent over to drink. Then he straightened up and dabbed his chin with the back of his hand. He put both hands behind his back and began to stroll around the waiting room as if he were on a promenade. But Miss Dent could see his eyes scanning the floor, the empty benches, the ashtrays. She understood he was looking for matches, and she was sorry she didn't have any. The woman had turned to follow the old man's progress. She raised her voice and said, Kentucky Fried Chicken at the North Pole. Colonel Sanders in a parka and boots. That tore it. That was the limit. The old man didn't answer. He continued his circumnavigation of the room and came to a stop at the front window. He stood at the window, hands behind his back, and looked out onto the empty parking lot. The woman turned around to Miss Dent. She pulled at the material under the arm of her dress. The next time I want to see home movies about Point Barrow, Alaska, and its Native American Eskimos, I'll ask for them. My God, it was priceless. Some people will go to any lengths. Some people will try to kill their enemies with boredom. But you'd have needed to be there. The woman stared hotly at Miss Dent as if daring her to contradict. Miss Dent picked up the handbag and placed it on her lap. She looked at the clock, which seemed to be moving very slowly, if at all. You don't say much, the woman said to Miss Dent. But I'll wager you could say a lot if someone got you started. Couldn't you? But you're a sly boots. You'd rather just sit with your prim little mouth while other people talk their heads off. Am I right? Still Waters. Is that your name? The woman asked. What do they call you?
Miss Dent. But I don't know you, Miss Dent said.
I sure as hell don't know you either, the woman said. Don't know you and don't care to know you. Sit there and think what you want. It won't change anything. But I know what I think, and I think it stinks. The old man left his place at the window and went outside. When he came back in a minute later, he had a cigarette burning in his holder, and he seemed in better spirits. He carried his shoulders back and his chin out. He sat down beside the woman.
I found some matches, he said. There they were, a book of matches right next to the curb. Someone must have dropped them.
Basically, you're lucky, the woman said. And that's a plus in your situation. I always knew that about you, even if no one else did. Luck is important.
The woman looked over at Miss Dent and said,
Young lady, I'll wager you've had your share of trial and error in this life. I know you have. The expression on your face tells me so. But you aren't going to talk about it. Go ahead then, don't talk. Let us do the talking. But you'll get older. Then you'll have something to talk about. Wait until you're my age, or his age, the woman said and jerked her thumb at the old man. God forbid. But it'll all come to you in its own sweet time. It'll come. You won't have to hunt for it either. It'll find you. Miss Dent got up from the bench with her handbag and went over to the water fountain. She drank from the fountain and turned to look at them. The old man had finished smoking. He took what was left of his cigarette from the holder and dropped it under the bench. He tapped the holder against his palm, blew into the mouthpiece, and returned the holder to his shirt pocket. Now he, too, gave his attention to Miss Dent. He fixed his eyes on her and waited along with the woman. Miss Dent gathered herself to speak. She wasn't sure where to begin, but she thought she might start by saying she had a gun in her handbag. She might even tell them she'd nearly killed a man earlier that night. But at that moment, they heard the train. First, they heard the whistle, then a clanging sound, an alarm bell, as the guardrails went down at the crossing. The woman and the white-haired old man got up from the bench and moved toward the door. The old man opened the door for his companion, and then he smiled and made a little movement with his fingers for Miss Dent to precede him. She held the handbag against the front of her blouse and followed the older woman outside. The train tooted its whistle once more as it slowed and then ground to a stop in front of the station. The light on the cab of the engine went back and forth over the track. The two cars that made up this little train were well lighted, so it was easy for the three people on the platform to see that the train was nearly empty. But this didn't surprise them. At this hour, they were surprised to see anyone at all on the train. The few passengers in the cars looked out through the glass and thought it strange to find these people on the platform, making ready to board a train at this time of night. What business could have taken them out? This was the hour when people should be thinking of going to bed. The kitchens in the houses up on the hills behind the station were clean and orderly. The dishwashers had long ago finished their cycle. All things were in their places. Nightlights burned in children's bedrooms. A few teenaged girls might still be reading novels, their fingers twisting a strand of hair as they did so. But television sets were going off now. Husbands and wives were making their own preparations for the night. The half dozen or so passengers, sitting by themselves in the two cars, looked through the glass and wondered about the three people on the platform. They saw a heavily made-up, middle-aged woman wearing a rose-colored knit dress mount the steps and enter the train. Behind her came a younger woman dressed in a summer blouse and skirt who clutched a handbag. They were followed onto the train by an old man who moved slowly and who carried himself in a dignified manner. The old man had white hair and a white silk cravat, but he was without shoes. The passengers naturally assumed that the three people boarding were together, and they felt sure that whatever these people's business had been that night, it had not come to a happy conclusion. But the passengers had seen things more various than this in their lifetime. The world is filled with business of every sort, as they well knew. This still was not as bad, perhaps, as it could be. For this reason, they scarcely gave another thought to these three who moved down the aisle and took up their places, the woman and the white-haired old man next to each other, the young woman with the handbag a few seats behind. Instead, the passengers gazed out at the station and went back to thinking about their own business, those things that had engaged them before the station stop. The conductor looked up the track. Then he glanced back in the direction the train had come from. He raised his arm and, with his lantern, signaled the engineer. This was what the engineer was waiting for. He turned a dial and pushed down on a lever. The train began to move forward. It went slowly at first, but it began to pick up speed. It moved faster until once more it sped through the dark countryside, its brilliant cars throwing light onto the roadbed. Fever. Carlyle was in a spot. He'd been in a spot all summer, since early June when his wife had left him. But up until a little while ago, just a few days before he had to start meeting his classes at the high school, Carlyle hadn't needed a sitter. He'd been a sitter,
Every day and every night he'd attended to the children. Their mother, he told them, was away on a long trip. Debbie, the first sitter he contacted, was a fat girl, 19 years old, who told Carlyle she came from a big family. Kids loved her, she said. She offered a couple of names for reference. She penciled them on a piece of notebook paper. Carlyle took the names, folded the piece of paper, and put it in his shirt pocket. He told her he had meetings the next day. He said she could start to work for him the next morning. She said, "Okay." He understood that his life was entering a new period. Eileen had left while Carlyle was still filling out his grade reports. She'd said she was going to Southern California to begin a new life for herself there. She'd gone with Richard Hoops, one of Carlyle's colleagues at the high school. Hoops was a drama teacher and glass-blowing instructor who'd apparently turned his grades in on time, taken his things, and left town in a hurry with Eileen. Now, the long and painful summer nearly behind him, and his classes about to resume, Carlyle had finally turned his attention to this matter of finding a babysitter. His first efforts had not been successful. In his desperation to find someone, anyone, he'd taken Debbie on. In the beginning, he was grateful to have this girl turn up in response to his call. He'd yielded up the house and children to her as if she were a relative. So he had no one to blame but himself, his own carelessness, he was convinced, when he came home early from school one day that first week and pulled into the drive next to a car that had a big pair of flannel dice hanging from the rearview mirror. To his astonishment, he saw his children in the front yard, their clothes filthy, playing with a dog big enough to bite off their hands. His son, Keith, had the hiccups and had been crying. Sarah, his daughter, began to cry when she saw him get out of the car. They were sitting on the grass and the dog was licking their hands and faces. The dog growled at him and then moved off a little as Carlyle made for his children. He picked up Keith and then he picked up Sarah. One child under each arm, he made for his front door. Inside the house, the phonograph was turned up so high the front windows vibrated. In the living room, three teenaged boys jumped to their feet from where they'd been sitting around the coffee table. Beer bottles stood on the table and cigarettes burned in the ashtray. Rod Stewart screamed from the stereo. On the sofa, Debbie, the fat girl, sat with another teenaged boy. She stared at Carlyle with dumb disbelief as he entered the living room. The fat girl's blouse was unbuttoned. She had her legs drawn under her and she was smoking a cigarette. The living room was filled with smoke and music. The fat girl and her friend got off the sofa in a hurry.
"Mr. Carlyle, wait a minute," Debbie said. "I can explain."
"Don't explain," Carlyle said. "Get the hell out of here, all of you, before I throw you out." He tightened his grip on the children.
"You owe me for 4 days," the fat girl said as she tried to button her blouse. She still had the cigarette between her fingers. Ashes fell from the cigarette as she tried to button up. "Forget today. You don't owe me for today. Mr. Carlyle, it's not what it looks like. They dropped by to listen to this record."
"I understand, Debbie," he said. He let the children down onto the carpet, but they stayed close to his legs and watched the people in the living room. Debbie looked at them and shook her head slowly as if she'd never laid eyes on them before.
"God damn it, get out," Carlyle said. "Now, get going, all of you."
He went over and opened the front door. The boys acted as if they were in no real hurry. They picked up their beer and started slowly for the door. The Rod Stewart record was still playing. One of them said,
"That's my record."
"Get it,"
Carlyle said. He took a step toward the boy and then stopped.
"Don't touch me, okay? Just don't touch me," the boy said.
He went over to the phonograph, picked up the arm, swung it back, and took his record off while the turntable was still spinning. Carlyle's hands were shaking.
"If that car's not out of the drive in 1 minute, 1 minute, I'm calling the police."
He felt sick and dizzy with his anger. He saw, really saw, spots dance in front of his eyes.
"Hey, listen, we're on our way, all right? We're going," the boy said.
They filed out of the house. Outside, the fat girl stumbled a little. She weaved as she moved toward the car. Carlyle saw her stop and bring her hands up to her face. She stood like that in the drive for a minute,
Then one of the boys pushed her from behind and said her name. She dropped her hands and got into the back seat of the car.
"Daddy will get you some clean clothes," Carlyle told his children, trying to keep his voice steady. "I'll give you a bath and put you into some clean clothes. Then we'll go out for some pizza. How does pizza sound to you?"
"Where's Debbie?"
Sarah asked him.
"She's gone," Carlyle said.
That evening, after he'd put the children to bed, he called Carol, the woman from the school he'd been seeing for the past month. He told her what had happened with his sitter.
"My kids were out in the yard with this big dog," he said. "The dog was as big as a wolf. The babysitter was in the house with a bunch of her hoodlum boyfriends. They had Rod Stewart going full blast, and they were tying one on while my kids were outside playing with this strange dog."
He brought his fingers to his temples and held them there while he talked.
"My God," Carol said. "Poor sweetie, I'm so sorry."
Her voice sounded indistinct. He pictured her letting the receiver slide down to her chin, as she was in the habit of doing while talking on the phone. He'd seen her do it before. It was a habit of hers he found vaguely irritating. Did he want her to come over to his place, she asked. She would. She thought maybe she'd better do that. She'd call her sitter. Then she'd drive to his place. She wanted to. He shouldn't be afraid to say when he needed affection, she said.
Carol was one of the secretaries in the principal's office at the high school where Carlyle taught art classes.
She was divorced and had one child, a neurotic 10-year-old the father had named Dodge after his automobile.
"No, that's all right," Carlyle said. "But thanks, thanks, Carol. The kids are in bed, but I think I'd feel a little funny, you know, having company tonight."
She didn't offer again.
"Sweetie, I'm sorry about what happened, but I understand you're wanting to be alone tonight. I respect that. I'll see you at school tomorrow."
He could hear her waiting for him to say something else.
"That's two babysitters in less than a week," he said. "I'm going out of my tree with this."
"Honey, don't let it get you down," she said. "Something will turn up. I'll help you find somebody this weekend. It'll be all right, you'll see."
"Thanks again for being there when I need you," he said. "You're one in a million, you know."
"Night, Carlyle."
After he'd hung up, he wished he could have thought of something else to say to her instead of what he'd just said. He'd never talked that way before in his life. They weren't having a love affair, he wouldn't call it that. But he liked her. She knew it was a hard time for him, and she didn't make demands. After Eileen had left for California, Carlyle had spent every waking minute for the first month with his children. He supposed the shock of her going had caused this, but he didn't want to let the children out of his sight. He'd certainly not been interested in seeing other women, and for a time he didn't think he ever would be. He felt as if he were in mourning. His days and nights were passed in the company of his children. He cooked for them. He had no appetite himself. Washed and ironed their clothes, drove them into the country where they picked flowers and ate sandwiches wrapped up in waxed paper. He took them to the supermarket and let them pick out what they liked. And every few days they went to the park, or else to the library, or to the zoo. They took old bread to the zoo so they could feed the ducks. At night, before tucking them in, Carlyle read to them. Aesop, Hans Christian Andersen, The Brothers Grimm.
"When is Mama coming back?"
one of them might ask him in the middle of a fairy tale.
"Soon," he'd say. "One of these days. Now listen to this."
Then he'd read the tale to its conclusion, kiss them, and turn off the light. And while they'd slept, he had wandered the rooms of his house with a glass in his hand, telling himself that, yes, sooner or later Eileen would come back. In the next breath, he would say,
"I never want to see your face again. I'll never forgive you for this, you crazy bitch." Then, a minute later, "Come back, sweetheart, please. I love you and need you. The kids need you, too."
Some nights that summer, he fell asleep in front of the TV and woke up with the set still going and the screen filled with snow. This was the period when he didn't think he would be seeing any women for a long time, if ever. At night, sitting in front of the TV with an unopened book or magazine next to him on the sofa, he often thought of Eileen. When he did, he might remember her sweet laugh,
or else her hand rubbing his neck if he complained of a soreness there. It was at these times that he thought he could weep. He thought, you hear stuff like this happening to other people. Just before the incident with Debbie, when some of the shock and grief had worn off, he'd phoned an employment service to tell them something of his predicament and his requirements. Someone took down the information and said they would get back to him. Not many people wanted to do housework and babysit, they said, but they'd find somebody. A few days before he had to be at the high school for meetings and registration, he called again and was told there'd be somebody at his house first thing the next morning. That person was a 35-year-old woman with hairy arms and run-over shoes. She shook hands with him and listened to him talk without asking a single question about the children, not even their names. When he took her into the back of the house where the children were playing, she simply stared at them for a minute without saying anything. When she finally smiled, Carlyle noticed for the first time that she had a tooth missing. Sarah left her crayons and got up to come over and stand next to him. She took Carlyle's hand and stared at the woman. Keith stared at her too. Then he went back to his coloring. Carlyle thanked the woman for her time and said he would be in touch. That afternoon, he took down a number from an index card tacked to the bulletin board at the supermarket. Someone was offering babysitting services. References furnished on request. Carlyle called the number and got Debbie, the fat girl. Over the summer, Eileen had sent a few cards, letters, and photographs of herself to the children, and some pen and ink drawings of her own that she'd done since she'd gone away. She also sent Carlyle long, rambling letters in which she asked for his understanding in this matter. This matter. But told him that she was happy. Happy. As if, Carlyle thought, happiness was all there was to life. She told him that if he really loved her, as he said he did, and as she really believed, she loved him too, don't forget, then he would understand and accept things as they were. She wrote, "That which is truly bonded can never become unbonded."